Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, this, the primaries are rolling on. The Potomac primaries last night. Barack Obama taking a decisive win over Hillary Clinton. And in fact, even in the categories that, well, the specific category of white males that had been some side, some commentators, shall we say, had been saying, well, no, this is just an African-American phenomenon. No. This guy has demonstrated he can cross over into any group. Latinos increasingly, so Hillary Clinton's looking over her shoulder. She didn't even mention him last night in her speech in Texas. We'll get into that in a little more detail as we go on with the day. Right now, though, first I wanted to bring on David Horowitz. He's the president of the Center for the Study of Popular of Culture and HorowitzFreedomCenter.org, his website. And David, welcome back to the program. Great meeting you last week at CPAC.
Thanks for having me on. Since I'm a Republican, let me say, I think it was a conclusive victory. Obama is going to be the Democratic nominee.
I suspect you may be right.
To deny him that would destroy the Democratic Party. It's not going to happen. And I think the most significant figure is not white males, but white females.
Yeah.
If you listen to Dick Morris, as I did last spring, he said Hillary was a shoo-in for the presidency because she had all these single white females who were going to vote for her to come hell or high water. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Obama is a charismatic leader. And you've got an emotional tide going, which is going to sweep him certainly to the nomination. I think
he's definitely one of those once in a generation. And
I was rooting for Hillary because she'll be easier for Republicans to beat.
And John McCain last night.
Your
party is saying to John McCain, "Hey, get with the program here by voting for Huckabee." It seems, even though Huckabee doesn't have any possibility of winning.
But
anyway, what I wanted to talk with you about today is Gene Nickel, the president of the College of William and Mary. This is the college that Thomas Jefferson went to. I mean, a long, long history of A, being a college, and B being a liberal in the Enlightenment sense college, resigned because of the college board of visitors not renewing his contract, in part because of efforts. I'm not sure if you were directly involved with them, but certainly groups that you have you would consider probably yourself aligned with. And I'm wondering, has the political correctness right now turned into a brown shirt movement?
Well, I don't think this has anything to do with the political correctness. You know, all you have to do people know what happened? I mean,
let's set it up.
The College of William and Mary goes back before the Revolution, and it was an Anglican college that, through the Revolution, became Episcopalian. There's a Wren Chapel. I guess it's named after Christopher Wren, mm-hmm. who was a 17th-century English architect, and it was associated, I guess, in its denominational days, with the Burton Parish. And there's a Wren cross that the parish had, and there was a Wren on the campus. And they moved in the 30s. They moved the Wren cross
into the chapel,
onto the altar of the chapel.
Right. And what this guy did, what Nichols said, is that he decided to move the cross out of the chapel so that Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and other religious minorities would feel comfortable being part of the chapel. I've sat in a lot of airport chapels over the years. I like to go in there and just sit and chill out a little bit, particularly before a long international flight or something. I enjoy that. I'll sit there and meditate for a half hour or something. And, you know, there's no crosses. There's no Muslim symbols. There's no any symbols. There's, you know, usually typically stained glass.
Right.
And it's a very all-embracing and welcoming feeling. And this is a college, William and Mary, that literally has students from all religious, you know, right down to animists. I mean, all religious denominations and groups. What's wrong with what's wrong with taking down the cross in there and saying everybody's welcome? Don't feel like this is just
okay. Well,
thing.
Airports are secular institutions that are very recent vintage. I mean,
The issue so are colleges.
Well, wait, Tom. Just to do the thought exercise. Suppose there was a Muslim university in America that dated back to revolutionary times and had a, you know, the Koran or something on the, well, they don't have altars, but whatever. And then some anti-Muslim or secularist or whatever you want to call it, president comes in and says, to make everybody feel welcome, we're going to strip the last vestige of the heritage of this institution and take it away. I mean, there's nothing to have.
Well, William and Mary was not established as a Christian school.
Creating a chapel. I mean, it is a chapel. You know,
right. It's a non-denominational chapel. It's a non-secular chapel.
Wait a second. It's a chapel. It's still the Wren Chapel. I mean, why not create a prayer room or a meditation room, better, non-denominational? You know, build a bigger one, but leave. This is a symbol of a tradition at the university.
Come on, David. This was just divide and conquer stuff. This whole Save the Wren Cross campaign was, it was led by Newt Gingrich's policy director. This was a cheap political stunt.
Now, look, Tom, I could, if I had the time, I could go up on the Internet, and I could take every person who was defending it and give them a political. Of course, this is the culture war, but the way to back off in the culture war, you have to understand who the aggressor is here. This was a move against just a tradition. It was a standing tradition.
It was not a tradition. That cross had been there 30 years.
Defenders said, then there were, we had the celebration of prostitutes officially supported by the university. Yeah, I happen to be.
That was something that he expressed his personal disapproval over. But he said, hey, if the students are going to do something and they're going to make this decision, and then Michelle Malkin gets into it and she decides to turn this into a PR stunt.
Mary is just culturally somewhat conservative. It would be like going into, of course, Antioch doesn't exist anymore, or, some left-wing car. Well,
say Goddard, where I was on the
taking the pictures
staff.
Of the portraits of Angela Davis and Bettina Apteker are off their hall of fame or something, you'd have an uproar.
Now, this is a different thing. We're talking about religion. We're talking about the ability of people from all faiths to feel comfortable with that religion. In that,
practicing. You're against Muslim foot baths in the bathrooms because they might offend a Christian or a Jew or an atheist?
Muslim foot baths, first of all, it's a side issue because we're not talking about the inside of the chapel.
It's very basic. You can't go around being offended every time somebody says, has a...
I'm not offended. I don't think anybody was. This wasn't a question about it being offended. The offended guy was Newt Gingrich's policy director that the cross wasn't put up there. What this guy was doing was he wasn't offended by the cross. He was saying, let's make this place more welcoming to everybody, including Christians.
If leftists want to go around denuding the country of all its Christian symbols, it's going to...
Nobody is suggesting leftists... Anybody wants to denude the country of its Christian symbols.
The left has created the Christian right. There was no Christian right before Roe v. Wade. Why did the Christian right arise? Because of the assault on,
Come on, David. The Christian right used to be called the Ku Klux Klan. It was the Christian order of the Ku Klux Klan. They were lynching in Jesus' name. You know this, David.
You're better than that. Come on now.
You know that there has always been a Christian right in the United States and an intolerant one. The reason that Ben Franklin left Massachusetts to move to Pennsylvania when he was 17 years old was because he was tired of seeing women being hung as witches. You know this?
I mean, this is just lunacy.
No, I'm saying there's always been a Christian right in the United States.
For 200 years, there were, I went to school in the 1940s and 50s. I went to elementary school in the 40s. Every Wednesday, we had an assembly, and the teacher would come in and read a psalm. Mm. That went on for 200 years until 1964, when the Supreme Court decided you can't do that in public schools.
We don't know that it went on for 200 years. We didn't have national school systems for 200 years. It went on basically from the 50s.
If you go around calling all members of the religious right Ku Klux Klanners. You will.
I didn't say that, David. I said there's always been a religious right. You said it was created by the secular left. I said it started with the Puritans.
If you continue to call, label all Christian conservatives as Ku Klux Klanners, you will continue to fuel that movement.
I absolutely agree with you, and that's why I didn't do it. David Horowitz, HorowitzFreedomCenter.org.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. We don't need no education. We don't need no self-control. Dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Leave them kids alone, teacher! Welcome back. Well, I find it very interesting that the folks on the right are suggesting that the political correctness right is a product of the left. I mean, it just a recent product of the left. It just blows my mind. You know, at the Jefferson Monument in Washington, D.C., there's this beautiful monument, and there's this dome, and around the top of the dome are some of the most famous words of Thomas Jefferson. It's from a letter that he wrote in 1800. It was about 3 months before he was elected president of the United States. He was the vice president to John Adams. He was running against John Adams for the presidency. And one of the charges being made against him by John Adams was that Thomas Jefferson was not a Christian, which in fact was true. Thomas Jefferson was a deist. And it had become a big issue in the election of 1800. And the words that are around the top of the Jefferson Monument are, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. And a lot of folks have said, ah, see, Jefferson really was a religious guy. Well, he was a very spiritual guy. He was an intensely spiritual guy. You get that from his reading, from reading his writings. But let's put this in context. Jefferson in 1800, where did that quote come from? Jefferson was battling the religious right in the election of 1800 in the form of John Adams and his associates who were making religion an issue in that election. And Jefferson didn't think it should be an issue. And made it very clear. And so in 1800, he wrote a letter to his old friend Benjamin Rush, who was also a deist. Somebody who believed in a greater power, something out there that brought it all into being, but was not a Christian. And in his letter to Benjamin Rush, Rush actually was a Unitarian as well as a deist. In his letter to Benjamin Rush, he is embedded that quote. But here's the entire letter, or the majority of the letter. This is about two-thirds of the letter. He said, Dear Sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. He was, you know, noting that he knew the topic was going to fuel the fires of electoral politics around them. In fact, in the letter, later on in the letter, he asked Ben Rush not to release it to the public. He said, but back to quoting from the letter, he said, I do know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum, genus, you know, the species, the category irritable vatum, is literally a Latin. In the Latin, it means the angry priests, or arguably the angry poets, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, he's speaking out of the First Amendment, which guarantees religious freedom and the separation of church and state. He says, the delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which, while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form to be the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. And then Jefferson gets right to the nub of it. And I'm not, editing or deleting any part of this. This is the continuous letter from Thomas Jefferson to Benjamin Rush in 1800, 3 months before he was elected president. He says, the returning good sense of our country. Now, he's talking about his hopes for his own election as presidency. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And the preachers believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, and enough too, in their opinion. In other words, here's Jefferson saying he's not going to be promoting religion as president of the United States. And this is the issue. The United States was created as a secular nation. We were not created as a religious nation. And the founders, many of the founders are very religious. I mean, Patrick Henry was what might today be a Jerry Falwell type of Christian. Many of the founders were very religious, and they got it that if they wanted their varied religious beliefs to be safe and secure, from the pilgrims to the Congregationalists, the Episcopalians, to, I mean, right across the board, there were even some Jews among the early guys, the whole bunch of them. And Jefferson, you know, in on a couple of occasions talking about the Mohammedans, you know, Islam and the Hindus, that they should all be embraced, that if they wanted to have the maximum freedom of religion in the United States, that public institutions outside of religious institutions, public institutions that were not religious institutions, should embrace all religions in a way that doesn't favor any. Secular doesn't mean anti-religious. It means separate from religion. We're about the commons. We're about the police and the fire and the parks and the schools, not about the church. That's all. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You work hard every day. Not for fame or fortune do they strive. But the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay. And it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit. Auto worker, let me thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it on down the line.
Yeah, my dad was one of those.
Hello, Pittsburgh. Steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time.
And greetings to our friends at WPTT in Pittsburgh.
Just to send it on down the line.
Yeah, sending it down the line. Well, you know, last night, after the election, Hillary Clinton made the comment. She said, there's a great saying in Texas, you've all heard it, all hat and no cattle. Well, after 7 years of George Bush, we need a lot less hat and a lot more cattle. And it was a nice statement. It was a nice statement, but it wasn't a strong statement of policy. And what I'm here, there was one clip in particular that I heard last night that was a statement of a strong populist, John Edwards kind of sounding statement of policy from Barack Obama. So this is my sound clip for the day. And I have to share this with you, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here on David Horowitz, on the elections, on you know, religious freedom in America, whatever you'd like to talk about. But this, where Barack Obama actually takes on A, lobbyists, and B, NAFTA. Amazing. Here it is.
It's a game where lobbyists write check after check, and Exxon turns record profits while you pay the price at the pump and our planet is put at risk. That's what happens when lobbyists set the agenda, and that's why they won't drown out your voices anymore when I am president of the United States of America.
Now, that was one huge applause line, but then he got, frankly, in my opinion, even better. He takes on our crazy trade deals, something that Bill Clinton was a big advocate for.
It's a game where trade deals like NAFTA ship jobs overseas and force parents to compete with their teenagers to work for minimum wages at the local fast food joint or at Walmart. It's what happens when the American worker doesn't have a voice at the negotiating table, when leaders change their positions on trade with the politics of the moment. And that is why we need a president who will listen not just to Wall Street, but to Main Street, a president who will stand with workers, not just when it's easy, but when it's hard. And that's the kind of president I intend to be when I'm president of the United States of America.
There you go. So I sense a change, but you know, we'll see. Again, we'll see. I still think that they're both great candidates. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Hey, Tim, it says here you disagree with me. Tim in Detroit, Michigan. So you go to the front of the line. What's up?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me get this straight. Okay, the College of William and Mary, it's a private institution, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so as I understand it, and I just heard about the story today, so I may not have all the facts, but the leadership pretty much supported the idea of what was it removing the cross from the church?
First of all, it's not a church; it's a chapel.
A chapel, rather.
Secondly, yeah, the president of the college was made the decision to remove this cross, which had only been there for 30 years. It was it had some sort of historic significance.
Okay.
But he took it off but it was put up not just like on the wall or something. It was put right up at the very front on the by the altar, and so he made the decision to take it off the altar, and so that people from all religions would feel comfortable coming into that chapel to pray, and or meditate or whatever. And the chief of staff to Newt Gingrich turned this into a whole political hoop-de-doop and got a bunch of conservatives on campus all flipped out about it. And they, in my opinion, they launched a witch hunt against this guy.
Well, let me say this. While I'm loath to defend any conservatives, including Mr. Horowitz and Gingrich, I take their side in the position of fairness, and this is how I would argue it, that since it is a private institution, they pretty much, you know, obviously within the law, have a right to declare any part of the college, let's say a religious, institution, or they can move a cross or the Star of David anywhere they want. So I think this is more of an internal matter within the college.
Yeah, I don't disagree broadly, although there may be an issue here of some federal funding coming in or whatever. I don't think so. But I don't disagree. And that's the point where, I don't think that this guy, I think this decision would have stood. This chapel has been a non-denominational chapel for a long, long time. Thomas Jefferson, who went to that school, certainly would have wanted it to be a non-denominational chapel. I just see this as the outcome of a witch hunt. I mean, pure and simple.
So. I just thought of an idea. Why not leave it up to some sort of a referendum among the students themselves and have them vote on it?
Oh, that would be a very interesting one, Tim, although, you know, typically that's not how colleges run. They're loath to do that, but it probably would be a good idea. 1-866-303-2270, your number. Steven in Missouri. Hey, Steven.
How you doing today, sir?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
I actually have to disagree with Mr. Horowitz and agree with you. You are quite correct. The religious right has always been there since the founding of the country. They've just changed names is all.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 80s and the early 90s, they were the Christian Coalition until they got busted for tax fraud, if I remember right.
Yep.
And then now they're actually pretty much more open, more in the open than they've ever been. And when Mr. Horowitz, the left created the religious right, no.
No, and it's always been the intolerant religious right, let me add. I mean, that's the tragedy of it. I mean, you know, many of us who consider ourselves spiritual and have some identity, you know, I consider myself a Christian with religious institutions, are just frankly and openly offended by this. Stephen, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts. Milton in Los Angeles. Hey, Milton.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. It's actually Nelson.
Oh, Nelson. I'm sorry.
No worries. Hey, just real quick, doesn't Obama have this warm hint of a Kennedy thing going on? I don't know.
Yeah, it's only been noted about 1,000 times.
I know, but still, man.
Yeah.
He is definitely
charismatic.
Exactly. Just a couple quick points.
But let me just add, if I may, since you brought that up. I have not focused on his charisma on this program, and I don't frankly think that that's a reason to vote for somebody. I mean, it may be a reason that somebody it is, or not the reason. It's a reason, but it's not the reason. But when a political candidate for president of the United States starts saying, we're going to throw the lobbyists out of Washington, D.C., we're going to get the money changers out of the temple, and we're going to rethink our trade deals, then I'm paying attention. And I think a lot of Americans are.
Oh, don't get me wrong. Believe me. I mean, the policies are there as well to back up pretty much all the emotion that is present. So I completely agree with you. Just a couple quick points on Mr. Horowitz. First, I have to commend you completely on having somebody from the right or conservative coming on in and having an open discussion and not, you know, reducing yourself to the O'Reillys of the world, where you talk over them, you cut their mics, or just not have them on.
Yeah, thank you. Although yesterday I had 3 cups of coffee before I had Dinesh D'Souza on, and I got a couple emails from people going, well, you know, hey, you know, get under control, and they were right. I only had I'm drinking green tea today.
Okay, good, fantastic, because you need that energy sometimes.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I am kind of, you know, really, really frustrated at the fact that this is kind of what the, and with all due respect to Mr. Horowitz, I've gathered you may be an acquaintance of yours, this is what the right does, you know. They gather whatever information that they can get and spin it, such as what you were mentioning, that the Christians were originally founded by KKK. You know, or not necessarily.
Well, not that, but, you know, that we've always had an intolerant right that is grounded in Christianity. And the KKK was so grounded in Protestant Christianity that they were nearly as opposed to Catholics as they were to African Americans and Jews.
And he gathered that. He gathered that and took it and spun it, saying, you're saying that all right, you know, Christians are KKK.
Yeah.
This is something that I've seen, you know, the right conservatives do years upon years, and it's appalling because it does destroy.
I know, and he spun it around and he said, if that's what you're saying, you're going to be in big trouble. And I said, yeah, that's why I didn't say it.
Exactly.
Thank you, Nelson, for pointing that out. I appreciate it. Robin, driving in California. Hey, Robin.
Yeah, for that guy to even suggest that you were saying something along those lines is ridiculous, Tom. A couple of points. One, on that, I've met you a few times, and just talking to you and you know, being in your presence, anybody can tell you're a very spiritual person. For him to come out with those guns, oh, it just got my hackles up. Another point. The religious right, the moral majority, as they were known back when Reagan was president, have always been, as my dear mother was once to tell me, neither moral nor religious, neither right.
Yeah, that is a great response to it. And I remember back when Jerry Falwell was promoting the moral majority, that comment, you know, they are neither. Yeah, very well said. Chris, and thank you for the call. Chris in Grand Rapids, just a minute before the break here, Chris.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to quickly comment on what you and your guests were talking about earlier. It seems the religious right takes stories like these and makes mountains out of molehills. They invoke tradition, and they say that it's attacking Christianity. Well, slavery was a tradition, and so was women not having rights. Just because it's a tradition doesn't make it right. It seems that Republicans, when they run, they don't run on vote for me because I'm the better candidate. They run on vote for me because it's what God would want you to do.
Well, it goes even beyond that. They don't run on what they're really running on, which is vote for them because they will hand the reins of this democracy over to a small group of very large and powerful corporations and people with inherited wealth. They can't run on that. That's the real agenda. The real agenda is economic. So instead they use these wedge issues. But spot on, Chris. You know, well said. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. TomHartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com as well, our message blog there. There's one on both sites. And 866-303-2270, our telephone number.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program. A bleeding heart independent. Tom Hartman, nationwide on AM 620 KPOJ.
Keep it on, my friends. Tom Hartman Radio Program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors on our local radio stations. And by the way, if you run across a company that you think should be advertising with your local radio station, tell them. And also supported by SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers, fighting for quality, affordable health care because they believe, and I believe, that health care in these United States should be a right, not a privilege. Time for our KGB alert for the day.
I took my problem to the KGB. Said there's this guy who won't agree with me. They took Litvinenko for some sushi and some wine, and just a little portion of Polonium 209.
Yes, well, it's happened again. The sudden death of an exiled Georgian billionaire may have been another Alexander Litvinenko-style murder, it is feared. Major crime squad investigating the death of 52-year-old Badri Patrashashvili, whose body was found at his country mansion in Surrey. This is in the UK at 11 o'clock last night. He's got an estimated $6 billion fortune. 1 month ago, Georgian prosecutors, that's the country of Georgia, the former Soviet state, the oil empire, charged him with plotting a coup after he had unsuccessfully tried to take on that country's president in the elections. In December, he told the Sunday Times he did not feel safe returning to his home country. That paper published extracts of a tape recording of a conversation said to have taken place between an official from the Georgian Interior Ministry and a possible hitman. The two men allegedly discussed two options for making Mr. Patrashashvili disappear completely, in quotes. And yesterday he did. So there you go. Our KGB alert for the day.
He looked suspicious when he saw his dish. He said it isn't safe to eat raw fish. They said it's okay, hey, the sushi is just fine. We're sure E. coli can't survive polonium 209.
Yeah, even E. coli can't survive polonium 209. By the way, just a heads up for our friends in Reno and in Los Angeles. Friday night, I will be in Reno. I'll be at the Borders at 5 p.m. at the Borders on South Virginia Street in Reno doing a book signing and a talk. We'll also be doing our show live from our affiliate in Reno. And in Los Angeles on February 16th, on Saturday night, I will be giving the keynote address and doing a rather protracted question and answer with folks in the audience for the Mensa group in Los Angeles. And that's at the Hacienda Hotel at LAX. But you do have to have tickets for that if you're going to participate. They have opened a limited number of seats to the public. And their phone number, 818-766-5314, if you want to show up. You do have to pay for dinner and the venue and all that kind of thing. So, anyhow, that's the deal. That's our travel schedule coming up this weekend. 1-866-303-2270. And let's see, Tina in Phoenix, Arizona. Tina, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. How about you, Tina?
Good. I'm real good. I just wanted to say I am a fundamentalist Christian. I am a homeschooling mom of three. And I completely agree with you on the issue of separation of church and state. And my husband and I are both so sickened by these people that call themselves Christians. And they are out there trying to take America back for Christ, as they call it. And not only is that unconstitutional, it's completely unchristian.
Well, and it's dangerous to religion. I mean, this was the big concern of many of the founders of this country, was that when the church and the state start messing in each other's business, it ain't a good thing for either one of them.
Exactly.
And by the way, one of our callers called and pointed out to us, and Lauren, our call screener, checked the Wikipedia. William & Mary actually is a public college. It is a publicly funded institution. It's not a private college. I was wrong on that. So all the more reason for the chapel, the non-denominational chapel, to actually be non-denominational.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Tina, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you,
Tom. It's great to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Purin, am I pronouncing that right in Los Angeles?
Purin Singh.
Hello, Purin Singh. What's up?
Hi. Well, first of all, I want to let you know that I've been a regular listener of yours, and before you were broadcast live, whenever you do Randy, I was telling people, now here's one of the sharpest people I've heard.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
Next, I want to let you know that I agree with your position on the William and Mary Cross situation, and actually, I've been trying for the last half hour to get on to let you know, first of all, that it is a public school. And second of all, the idea came to my mind that maybe, you could contact John Stewart, who is both Jewish and a graduate of William and Mary, and get his take on it.
And, oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize he had gone to William and Mary too. Yeah, that's a great idea, Pern. Thank you very much. And James, and thank you for the call. James in Mississippi. Hey, James.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I was so proud of you. And this is not the first time, but the way you got to Mr. Horowitz, that just shows you the dependence from the Republicans.
But see, I think he's a decent guy. He has an agenda. He's advancing. He has a set of beliefs that I think he genuinely believes in. I hope at the end of the day that we can all agree to disagree and still acknowledge each other's humanity.
Well, that's true. But the thing that got me is when you were telling him what historically is in the record, he didn't want to hear it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's sometimes a problem. James, thanks a lot for the call. Dion in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Dion.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's up?
I don't know if I'll be correcting you or maybe if you will enlighten me on this statement. Now, I'm not taking up for these people, but I recall that the Ku Klux Klan actually started in the Democratic Party.
The Ku Klux Klan and the Democratic Party had a long tradition of affiliation. I don't know if one arose out of the other. I frankly don't believe so. But the fact of the matter is, you're absolutely right. The Democratic Party from the 1830s up until, you know, up until after the Civil War was the party of slavery, and they were the party of discrimination until LBJ flipped them around. And
it's
not something for the Democratic Party to be proud of, and thank God they have changed. And now the Democratic Party, and thank you, Dion, for your call. We're out of time here. The Democratic Party now has an African-American who may well be the next president of the United States. What a wonderful thing.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our program. A vote happening as we speak in the House of Representatives on a 21-day extension of FISA. George Bush yesterday praising the Senate and the Democrats in the Senate who... the metaphors that come to mind are not things I can say on the radio. Yeah, let's say gave him a big, wet, sloppy kiss. And the House looks like they're going to have no part of it. And the House of Representatives say, no, okay, we'll give you another 21-day extension. And Bush saying, no, I'll veto it. So it's going to be interesting to see who calls whom's bluff, if I'm using my who's and whom's in the correct places there. It's going on right now. And John Boehner, Boehner, excuse me, has said several times now that he's going to call for motions to adjourn. He doesn't even want to have the conversation. And they kept having these motions to adjourn. That got shot down by the majority of the House of Representatives. So that vote is going on. We'll keep you up to date on that. Michael O'Hanlon is with us. He is a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Brookings Institute. Brookings.edu is the website. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you here. And thanks for coming in by ISDN. It sounds like you're right in the room here with me. Michael, you have been quoted as giving a gentleman's B on Iran to Bush, a B-plus on Iraq, your concerns about the Democrats, yet, historically your statements seem to have been all over the map. I'd like to ask a larger question rather than pick nits with you, although we'll see where our conversation goes. When are conservatives going to acknowledge victory in the war in Iraq? I mean, there actually was an end point to that war. Bush got up on the aircraft carrier, USS Abraham Lincoln, and said,
"My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed."
And he was right. And by any measure, we took down the country, we killed its leader, we took control of its institutions, we took control of its streets, we won the war. Then began what has become a five-year occupation. When is the language of this discussion going to reflect reality rather than this nonsense about winning and losing wars?
First of all, I don't speak for conservatives. Something you said a minute ago made me think you thought of me in those terms. I'm not. I like to think of myself as a moderate to hawkish Democrat, if you will, but I'm certainly a Democrat.
Okay.
Secondly, there are people who, and Henry Kissinger was one of them, who said we should just go in, overthrow Saddam, and leave, and let the place sort itself out, because our paramount goal is making sure Saddam can't threaten the region, or making sure his sons can't inherit that position and threaten the region in the future. There was that argument. I don't agree with either you or Henry Kissinger on this one, because I think that if you go in and you leave the place a mess, and that's, of course, we did leave the place a mess, and I am a big critic of President Bush for the sloppiness of the planning, but if you go in with the explicit goal of just going in, toppling Saddam, and getting out, you know you're going to create another Somalia or Afghanistan. That's the kind of place that terrorists like to hole up. That's the kind of operation that Muslims tend to criticize the United
None
States
of us want a failed state, Michael. None of us want a failed state.
But come on, you just said we're spending
$100 billion, $150 billion a year there. If you divide the population of Iraq by the amount of money we're spending, we could simply hand out to every Iraqi about five times the annual Iraqi income for a middle-class person. I mean, we could simply give them the money. And the obvious question, and I think you're as critical of this as I am, I'm guessing, is, you know, why didn't we do this in the very beginning? Just say, okay, here's a $100 billion Marshall Plan, and you guys build your own infrastructure and industry. And it looks to me like the reason why we didn't is because Bush and the Republican Party and a few Democrats wanted to be sure that most of that money did not end up with Iraqis, and that we didn't rebuild the Iraqi infrastructure, but instead it ended up with Halliburton and other companies.
I don't think you can go into this kind of an environment and avoid the fact that security comes first. And I don't think.
But
you
we
could.
Were secure right after we overthrew the government.
I don't agree with that. I don't think you could have done what you're proposing. I think what you had to do was do the security mission and do it right. Prevent the Ba'athists from coming back. Prevent an insurgency from arising. Unfortunately, we did a very poor job at that. But I do not think there was the political or security landscape where you could have done just sort of the economic plan that you proposed.
Well, Michael, in the weeks after the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein regime, I mean, we literally were greeted with flowers. I mean, there was a period of time there where the Iraqis were like, you know, thank God, now let's put this thing back together. And then Paul Bremer comes in and says, no, we're not going to let you put your country back together. We're going to do it our way. We're going to bring in foreign contractors, American contractors. We're going to give the hundreds of billions of dollars to the Bechtels and the Halliburtons of the world. And they're going to bring in labor from the Philippines, which is cheaper than the labor here in Iraq. And we're not going to rebuild your cement factories. And we're not going to rebuild your construction companies. And we're not going to hire your architectural firms. And we've got a five-year disaster here because of this year zero attempt to create a libertarian paradise that never has worked anywhere in the world and doesn't now.
Well, I agree with most of your criticisms of how they did things. I think it was a very poor operation. But I think there was a serious argument that we should try to create essentially a government in waiting. And you know that Shalaby was the preferred person for the Pentagon. And try to essentially create a benign strongman and pass the reins of power. And that is a serious proposition. I'm not going to disagree with you categorically on that. But if you're going to do that, what you have to do is go in with a very clear sense of who's the right person, work hard to give that person some legitimacy, and create an environment of stability starting from that day when we tolerated the looting. That was when our mistakes began. So it was even before Paul Bremer, even before that speech of Bush's that you just replayed. And I take your point. There is a serious argument in this sort of a situation for saying democracy in our style is a secondary priority. What you need is a stable form of a more benign autocratic rule, and that's good enough. And frankly, I would take that now if we could wish that.
It would be a bargain. The vast majority, I mean, you've got the second largest diaspora in the world behind Darfur right now. The second largest refugee disaster in the world is Iraq and Iraqis. You've got Iraqi kids as young as, you know, girls as young as 6 years old in Syria being prostituted out by their families, desperate for money. I mean, this was documented by CBS. You've got, I mean, it's 4.5 to 5 million Iraqis, perhaps as many as a million dead. And this is the blood on our hands. And apparently it's because the Bush administration and the Republicans looked at the success we had in Germany and Japan. My father was in the occupation forces in Japan, and, you know, I've heard a lot of stories about how it worked from him and I've read history. They were never shot at. There was never an insurgency. We went into those countries and we said, here's some money, here's some resources. You guys rebuild your country. We'll help to the extent that we can. And you guys put together your government and have your elections and make it work. We'll help you write a constitution and a democratic constitution. And instead, You know, they wanted this neoliberal thing, this or neoconservative, whichever you want to call it. Technically, it really is neoliberalism, of saying we're going to do away with borders, essentially, that any immigrant worker can come in and depress the price of labor in Iraq, that we're going to do away with borders as regard to multinational corporations. Any corporation can come in and buy up 100% of any Iraqi corporation. All of the domestic content laws were done away with. I mean, all the ways that countries traditionally, all those membranes that countries traditionally use to protect their economies and their cultures were ripped away. And it's disintegrated as a consequence of this.
Well, I agree with, again, your criticisms, but I accept that as you think theoretically about our options, creating a strong man would have been one of them. However, I have to say I am not sure we could have found that person, and I'm not sure it would have worked.
I'm not saying that we should even have created a strong man. What I'm saying is if we immediately got about the business of turning the lights on, getting the water running, getting the sewer systems running, rebuilding the buildings that we bombed indiscriminately, putting the hospitals back into place, and making sure that people were still getting their paychecks, particularly the army and the physicians and the teachers, all of which the Bushies wanted privatized. If we had just gone about doing that like we did in Germany and we did in Japan, that there's a very good chance that what we would have there would be something more, you know, a little closer to something like Jordan or some of the more benign, to use your word, semi-autocratic but semi-democratic institutions in the Middle East.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I think we have to underscore, and I'm not sure if you agree or disagree, let me just say the one piece of that I do think we would have to add to what you just listed is a strong American security presence for a while, and that would have then run the risk of engendering some of the resistance that we saw.
But I would argue if it was a strong American presence, security presence, we're just putting a bullseye on the back of our guys, and we're saying to the entire Muslim world, we the Christians have come in here to tell you guys how to run this show.
It needed to be
a strong presence run by the Arab League.
Well, that would have been fine if they would have done it. All I'm trying to say is that
if we got out of the way, they would have.
I'm not so sure. But it's a fine idea to put on the table. The problem is, as you know, that I think Bremer did make a big mistake disbanding the security forces, but they were also a mess. Somebody had to rebuild them. If the Arab League would have done it, that would have been great, but I'm not sure they would have.
Yeah, okay. Well, interesting conversation. Michael, thanks for dropping by. Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute, brookings.edu. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. The hour of the Tom Hartman radio program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 working to keep quality health and affordable health care available to all Americans. This quality health care should be a right, not a privilege here in these United States. Congratulations! Our caught you doing something right alert for the day. You know, it's so easy to catch people doing things wrong. I think it's important from time to time, you know, to catch people doing things right. Say good on you. Congratulations. Hey, congratulations, Donna Edwards and the Progressive Democrats of America. I realize I have a little self-interest in here because I'm on their advisory board, but nonetheless, PDA had chosen Donna Edwards. She was a Progressive Democrat, and in Maryland, there was an eight-term incumbent. This guy had been in the House of Representatives 16 years, Albert Wynn, and he was essentially a Joe Lieberman type of Democrat, a conservative Democrat. And this was a very Democratic, very progressive district. And so PDA said, we're going to support Donna Edwards. They did. And last night she beat Albert Wynn. And good on her. Congratulations, Donna Edwards and the Progressive Democrats of America. There you go. Jolly good fellas. Good on you all. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Aaron in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Aaron, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you so much for all the education and insight and wisdom that you provide. I've been listening to you for a long time, and I just really appreciate all your efforts.
Thank
the
you.
Thing that I wanted to address is with your last guest, he was talking about the war, as if the Iraq war, at least, as if there was some really good rationale that we were there. I mean, we were live.
Let's call it, by the way, the Iraq occupation, if I may.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, occupation. We were lied into it. It was for oil. It was, you know, I mean, it was not really for all the other alleged lies that we were told. It was to access their oil.
Yeah, as Darth Vader would say,
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Right, exactly. But there are a couple other points I wanted to make, and that is that there is no war that is won. No war war creates enemies. It creates more conflict. It is a primitive consciousness that we have got to change.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why the United Nations was created. And that's why when all the nations of the world signed the treaties necessary to become members of the United Nations, they said no more preemptive wars, no more proactive wars, no more aggressive wars. We will only go to war when we are faced with somebody like Hitler, who we have no choice but to go to war against. But my point is that while wars, actually, I would say semantically, wars are won or lost, occupations are appropriately ended. So when John McCain says, oh, Hillary Clinton wants to wave the white flag of surrender, that's because he's using the metaphor of war. And in the context of war, most Americans understand wars to be either won or lost. You know, Japan lost World War II. We won it. On the other hand, our occupation of Japan ended within about 2 years. We still have some forces on the bases there, but they're not occupying that country. They're there as guests of the Japanese government to protect the Pacific and some of our interests there. So everybody agrees that an occupation appropriately should come to an end. So if we can change the language of this thing to what it really truly is, which is an occupation and not a war, then the American people, then it will be very easy for a presidential candidate or a president, you know, say, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, to say, okay, you know, the occupation's gone on for 5 years. We've screwed it up. We haven't done it well. We know how to do an occupation well. We occupied Germany and Japan for a year or two. Not a single soldier died as a consequence of an insurgency in either one of those countries that we fought bitterly. I mean, tooth and nail, the German soldiers, the Japanese had suicide soldiers against us. And still, not a single soldier died in Japan after the end of the war. And because we did the occupation correctly and we ended it in a timely fashion. It's time to change our strategy in Iraq, to do the occupation appropriately and end it as quickly as we can. And that's my point. Aaron, thanks so much for calling and for raising the issue. I appreciate it. Steve in Portland. Hey, Steve.
Hey, again, in reference to your last guest, and also to the last caller, the war isn't about oil, actually. And the reason Bremer was put in place is because it could have ended reasonably.
Yeah,
but
very quickly.
The purpose is, and it's doing this perfectly, is to transfer billions of dollars from the U.S. Treasury to Halliburton and the other defense contractors.
I believe that was one of the purposes. I believe another one of the purposes, as George Bush told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, in 1999, before he was even running for president, was that if he became president and he had an opportunity to invade Iraq, he would do it, and he wouldn't blow it the way his dad did by having the war only last 100 hours. He would keep that war going long enough that he could gain political capital, and he could do things like privatize Social Security with that political capital, that he would have a successful presidency, end quote. And he was, you'll recall, initially reveling in being a war president. So I would say that there were a variety of reasons why this war happened. Number one, obviously, oil. You know, we wouldn't be doing this war if the main product there was broccoli. Number two, let's transfer hundreds of billions, arguably $1 trillion or more, to the corporate cronies of the Bush administration. And number three, to take the Senate back in the 2002 election, or in 2002 and 2004 and 2006 for political purposes.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I hope the days come easy and the moments pass slow, and each road leads you where you want to go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth and your smile. But more than anything,
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Harmon here with you. My wish for you is that your life become everything it can be and that we can collectively heal this planet of the damage that Professor Jack Forbes, the professor of Native American Studies at Davis, the University of California, Davis, once told me he referred to in his native language, his Native American language, as wetiko, this mental illness of let's consume the planet and produce waste and to hell with the future and forget about future generations, etc. Anyway, I digress. Strange things going on out there. Well, 70-year-old Betty Perry didn't think she was crazy. She just didn't want to mow her lawn. So she was arrested and handcuffed and thrown in jail for when they offered her a ticket for failing to water her lawn, saying, no thanks, won't take it. During her struggle with Officer Jim Flagare, she fell, injured her nose, rolled onto her stomach, put her hands under her to foil a handcuffing, and so they said it was really important to get a conviction in this case. Hey, Betty, I've got some advice for you. Back in the 70s, Louise and I lived in the old R.E. Olds mansion, which was this giant old house. It was kind of fallen down. Great big, huge old house on Grand River Avenue in Okemos, Michigan, East Lansing, Michigan. And it had a huge lawn, and there were a whole bunch of us living in it. It had been broken up into apartments and things. And collectively, none of us wanted to mow the lawn, and we kind of liked the fact that there were all these really cool weeds growing on the lawn. And Louise and I, in fact, were taking an herbalism class at Wayne State University at the time, and I was studying herbology. And the city came and said, you got to mow your lawn. And so what we did was we made plaques for all the weeds. We said, okay, this is yarrow. It's verbascum thapsus is mullein. This is mullein. It's verbascum thapsus. This is yarrow. It's Achillea millifolium. This is curly dock. It's whatever it is. I'm forgetting all my Latin names now. This was long ago and far away. And we created an herb garden. And we put a sign out that said, an herb garden and a nature walk. And the city backed down. They backed down. Because they had said that they were going to send out the mower and mow us and send us the bill for it. And they came out and they looked at the herb garden and said, this is kind of cool. You guys have an herb garden here. So, Betty, a little advice. There's always a way around these things. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And at TomHartmann.com, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Mike in Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I need your wisdom on something here. I've listened to you for a long time, and I'm going to give you a little credit, a lot of credit. You remind me a lot of some of my graduate school professors in the way that you explain things. And maybe you can help me out here. I've been following this primary for a while, and I noticed that a lot of people on our side of the fence are bashing Hillary about her war vote. They just can't come to grips with her war vote.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I said, John Kerry voted for the same war.
Yeah, and he also did not apologize the way that John Edwards did.
Exactly, and they know that that cherry-picked. Remember, we were supposed to have those hearings about cherry-picked intel that was used and fed to Congress to get them to go along with this.
Yep.
And they also found out lately, just recently, that we, the American people, and I'm sure as well as Congress, has lied to 935 times in the lead-up to war. Yet they keep bashing Hillary about her vote. Now, I'm going to tell you, I'm leaning toward Hillary here, and I'm like you, if Obama wins, I can vote for Obama because I just think any Democrat will be way better than a Republican. But I just have a hard time with my fellow Democrats who just bash and bash and bash her about this vote, and yet they seem to be totally oblivious to the fact that Kerry made that same vote.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line, Mike, is it's politics. I mean, people are going to use whatever they can use, and at least they're using that. I mean, that's a rather small thing to say, hey, she voted for the war, but now she says it was wrong, but she won't apologize. I mean, that's nothing compared to when the Republicans went after John Kerry and called him a flip-flopper and called him a liar, and they went after Al Gore and said, basically he had no moral character. He lied about saying he created the Internet when, in fact, he never even said that. The whole thing that John Kerry was not a war hero. He was actually, a war criminal of some. I mean, the Republican, I think this is a small hit, frankly, on Hillary. It's not one that you've ever heard on this show. I'll cut her some slack on it. I agree with you. I think either one of these candidates, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, would make a great president. Right. But we're not going to stop. You're not going to be able to stop people who don't like Hillary Clinton or who are Obama partisans from condemning her for her war, for not at least apologizing for her war vote.
I guess I'm not trying to stop them. I guess I just sit and I read things and I hear things and I listen to, you know, a lot of progressive radio and even some progressive radio show host that I've seen on television. You know, it's all, it seems to me like to them it's all about that war vote.
There's a lot of people, Mike, who just think it's sports. They're just, you know, oh, it's my team versus your team, and they're just taking sports positions. And I give my listeners more credit for intelligence than that. And that's the point I think that you're making, and I absolutely agree with you. Thank you for the call, Mike. Matthew in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Matthew.
Hello, how are you?
I am just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Okay. I called to talk about Thomas Jefferson and the chapel and that kind of stuff, but I'd just like to say one thing first. I drove from Charlottesville to D.C. yesterday to work at the phone banks at Hillary Clinton's campaign headquarters in Arlington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And walking around the city yesterday, it was really crazy because there was a lot of people who were for Obama, and they were very, very vocal. And there's this one kid standing at the stairs on the subway station, or the train station, the metro station, and he was just holding a Hillary sign, and he was freezing because there was, like, actually ice on his coat. And they were just taunting him. The Obama people were just taunting him because there's, like, four of them, and there's only one Hillary supporter standing there. And there were others across the city. I just kind of felt bad for him, and I think I kind of felt like that was kind of like a sad commentary on what this election has come to.
On the other hand, it's a wonderful commentary that people are out in the streets with signs.
Yeah, that.
I mean,
that
we've got an engaged electorate.
Yeah, I was really excited.
It's
about
a wonderful
that
thing.
Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I attend the University of Virginia here. It was founded by
the school that Thomas Jefferson founded, right?
Right, exactly. I thought it was interesting when he made up the plans for the school. There was no chapel involved.
That's
he
right.
even said he did not want a chapel. He said that the rotunda, which used to be the main building here, would be the library, which I guess the chapels used to be libraries in religious schools. But after he died, there was a very, very, like, strong influx of religious ideology in the school, and they said, well, we don't think it's right that this school doesn't have any religious affiliation, and they started making one up and then attributing it to him.
Oh, that's
interesting. I thought that was kind of sad. And then they finally built this chapel, and they wanted to make it an Episcopalian chapel, and everybody said, no, if we're going to do this, we'll make it non-denominational. But I just thought it was funny because everybody says that's Thomas Jefferson's chapel, and he never even wanted it here.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And there was this huge religious revival in the United States at the end of the 18th century and the early 19th century, and a lot of history got rewritten at that time, and a lot things like that happened. But Jefferson, in fact, created the University of Virginia as the first free university, so that anybody could attend. You know, he had the idea that anybody in the United States who could afford, who had the ability to go to college, whether they could afford it or not, should be able to. Matthew, thank you for the call. Well said. I really appreciate it. Jerry in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. You want to set me straight on something?
Well, yeah. I just wanted to comment on the caller who called in about Hillary two callers ago.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, in the John Kerry run for the presidency, John Kerry talked during his candidacy about regretting his vote on the Iraq War. Hillary hasn't done that. Now, I was a Joe Biden supporter in the beginning.
Yeah.
I've come around to being a Barack Obama supporter, but that's because of the scorched earth tactics I think the Clintons took on in South Carolina. And I like Barack. I like them both.
Yeah.
But you can't say that Hillary's being picked on for her vote, especially after she then turned around and voted to declare the Iraqi National Guard or whatever it is,
the Iranian Republican Guard.
Republican Guard, yes.
Yeah.
As a terrorist organization. She voted that way, knowing that giving that vote to the president could spur him to, oh, they're terrorists. Let's attack them now.
I know. I know. I was very concerned with, and I was very opposed to that vote, Jerry. And I don't disagree with your sentiment on that. There are, you know, there's going to be areas of policy disagreement with, for me anyway, with both of these candidates. But time will tell how it all shakes out. Thank you for your call, though. Joe in San Diego. Hey, Joe, just a half a minute here before our break.
Tom, I
right in 04 in San Diego, we had a speaker at the World Affairs Council who was, I guess, the Bush administration guy to set up the universities. And he came out and he was talking about how Saddam had built all these universities between the First War and the Second War to keep people off the streets, which seemed like a great idea. And I asked him, how much of the $86 billion was allocated to revamp the universities? $6 million.
Wow. That's like enough to redo the floors in one of the buildings.
It's nothing.
That's tragic. And that's been the priorities, Joe. Thank you very much. That's been the priorities of this administration. If you can give hundreds of billions of dollars to defense contractors who will then give it back to you in campaign contributions or jack up the value of Dick Cheney's stock on a no-bid basis with no oversight and no investigations, go for it. But if we're talking about rebuilding the institutions of civic society, forget it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Answer the question, it'll probably take more. If you're already there, well, you probably don't know. Well, we were the people that we wanted to know. And we're the places that we wanted to go.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Rudy Giuliani hitting the lecture circuit, going to make some bucks. The John Ashcroft defending the Iraqi invasion. Sportsmen coming out in favor of climate change legislation. A whole large group of sportsmen saying, we want to go out there and shoot things. We want to make sure that there's things there to shoot. And Sheryl Crow's new album, inspired by her apparently disgusting encounter with Karl Rove. Lots of interesting news over at thinkprogress.org and all over the Internet. However, the strangest news out there right now, Dolly Parton says she's got a call off. And by the way, this falls into the category of stories that I didn't want to do, but my two female producers said, yes, you will. Dolly Parton called off her North American tour because of back pain. Why the back pain? She says, hey, you try wagging these puppies around for a while and see if you aren't having back problems. Although I have to say, Dolly Parton is one of the most amazing singers and performers, regardless of her puppies, in the history of the world. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jim in Queens, New York, you wanted to challenge me on my World War II occupation comparison?
Hi, Tom. Yes, thank you. The issue I'm taking, you've probably heard this before, is that the occupations of both Japan and Germany are very different from occupying a country such as Iraq, where in Iraq you have three very distinct, at least three distinct factions. You have the Shia, you have the Sunni, you have the Kurds in the north, and you have many tribal differences in amongst them. Whereas in both Germany and Japan, you didn't have that. You had a much more homogeneous population, particularly 60 years ago.
Broadly speaking, yeah. There were factions and some very significant factions in Germany. The people in the south, from Munich, basically thought of the people from the north, like up in Hamburg, as absolute snobs and vice versa. But it wasn't anything like
it. It wasn't.
You're right.
And so, and yes, I do agree with you that if we were going to go in there, and if we had just toppled Saddam and left the infrastructure in place and left the police and the army by and large in place, things would have been different. I don't know if it would have been that much different, because he still would have had these simmering differences. But from yourself and others on the progressive side, of which I include myself, I do hear too many analogies of, the Marshall Plan. If we'd just done that in Iraq, it would be just like Japan and Germany afterwards.
Yeah, well, this is where this is what I think Michael O'Hanlon and I were talking about, is that the odds of a modern, full-blown, egalitarian democracy emerging in Iraq afterwards was very, very low. And although that's what we were being peddled. The odds of another strong man coming forward, another Saddam Hussein, who could actually hold the country together, albeit without democracy, but still the average person's life you know, the people could still go to college and people could still get jobs and things like that. And,
right.
And you didn't have a million people dead and you didn't have children dying of cholera. That would not have happened. I mean, we've got an enormous amount of blood on our hands as a consequence of this. The bottom line, though, is you're right. It's a war that never should have happened, and the circumstances are different. The other big difference I would say, Jim, and thank you for the call and comment on this, is that in Germany and Japan, you had people who had basically bought into a cult movement. Nazism and the worship of the emperor in Japan and Germany were essentially cults. I mean, I don't think that there's any other way to describe them. And in fact, I would say that some of the neocons are members of cults here in the United States. It's this irrational belief and irrational following of a leader in the face of overwhelming evidence that leader's not working to your benefit and, in fact, lying to you and all these kinds of things. And so when the Germans and the Japanese were presented with the war atrocities from the rape of Nanking to the death camps in Germany and outside of Germany, the Germans and the Japanese collectively said, oh, my God. You know, how could we have done this? And they were much more willing to go along, frankly. You know, they were, it was a deprogramming process. There was an awakening process. Well, the Iraqis, you know, throughout this thing, they weren't seeing Saddam anywhere near as much as the enemy as ultimately they've come to see us. And that's, so now what we're doing is we're creating cults within Iraq. And in Afghanistan as well. And this is why I don't think that we should have invaded Afghanistan in the first place. Perhaps a surgical strike to take out Osama bin Laden's training camps, fine. You know, particularly with the collaboration and approval of the world community. But trying to take over a country, sorry, that's what bled the Soviet Union to death in part, and it's bleeding us to death, and NATO as well. And NATO's starting to get very skittery about it. So it was just, you know, it was badly done. It was wrong. Paul in Albany, California. Hey, Paul. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, what's up?
Well, I have a couple of comments. One is, whenever we discuss Paul Bremer, we never discuss the fact that he worked for Kissinger and Associates. He was the number two person there.
Yeah, and before that, he was George Bush's roommate at Choate.
But my other problem,
or Andover, excuse me.
I know this is something that when you are a host, you somewhat have to be polite to guests. But O'Hanlon, who now still is at the Brookings Institute, he should just come clean and he should just move over to American Enterprise or Heritage Foundation because he's now become a creep.
Yeah, he has been all over the place on the issues, but he's not here to defend himself right now. So I'm just not going to go any farther with it. Max in St. Louis, about a half a minute before we've got to wrap up this hour, Max. Hey, Max? No, Max. Okay, Dan in Michigan. Just a few seconds, Dan.
Good afternoon, Tom. There is a contradiction in the conservative sphere with the completely belong the destruction of families and the decay.
Dan, sorry. two in a row. Dan, your phone was breaking up so badly I couldn't understand you. But, yeah, if you were going to talk about free trade, which I believe was your topic, it is destroying families in the United States. And I was so pleased to hear Barack Obama take on NAFTA last night. What a major, major step. God bless him. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you thought you know, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong, as the Fireside Theater reminds us.
Know that you're wrong. But you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible that everything you know is wrong? We have with us now John Pinkston. He's a retired USAF lieutenant colonel, founder and president and pastor of the Congregation of God Seventh Day in Kennesaw, Georgia, the author of several books, including The Hidden Truth About Marriage, Idolatry, America's Sin, and the Ten Commandments, as well as a collection of CDs on American prophecy. He is the weekly voice of the Watch America radio and TV shows. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm delighted to be with you.
John, you are out there beating the drums saying that the United States is headed toward one world government. Are you talking about the one world government from Revelation, or are you talking about something that is a little more secular?
No, both. It's secular, and also, of course, the thing in Revelation, that's not religious. That's like a news event that's in our future. And
well, I think people in a lot of other religions who are not Christians would disagree with you, but
they might.
But there is a variation of that in Islam as well.
Yes.
So this one world government, is what's it going to be? Who's it going to be?
Okay, basically what we're looking at, and it's also described in the Old Testament as well, and it tells us that it's going to be broken down into 10 world regions. And in 1974, business leaders, multinational corporations, and political leaders got together in Rome, and they kind of mapped out how they intended for the world to be in the future, because they recognized that business suffers in war. And because our corporations have become multinational, they've decided they got to put a stop to this.
Oh, business does very well in war.
Yeah,
I mean, look at what's happened. If we were not having a war in Iraq right now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average would probably be 2,000 points below where it is right now.
Well, the side that wins does okay, but the side that loses, look at Iraq, for instance. They're whatever they had in manufacturing, it's totally destroyed.
Yeah.
And looking back over history, that's exactly what many of the business leaders came together, and they really honchoed the formation of the League of Nations. It was a push for this in the United Nations. And
John, if business does poorly in war, human life does even worse.
Oh, yeah.
So what's wrong with saying we're all going to get together and stop war?
Well, everything would be okay about it, except the leader that will finally come into position in that is going to be a world despot. And
so you're suggesting that because the religion that you and I share has a scriptural story that has been interpreted probably at least 1,000 different ways over the last 1,000 years, but this modern interpretation that really started in the 1970s, I would argue, and popularized by Hal Lindsey at that time,
mm-hmm.
This modern interpretation therefore we should be advocating war, or we should be saying let's not have any international institutions that will cause peace because it might lead to something that our religion says is possible. Seems a little extreme to me, John.
Yeah, it does sound a little bit extreme. And let me just back up and say that how many wars has the UN stopped? And yet it was supposed to be put in place for that?
Well, we're not sure, but I would guess that it has probably stopped quite a few wars. I know that Dag Hammarskjöld died, you know, as he was trying to go into Angola to
mm-hmm.
stop a war there. He was a great peacemaker. I don't know if you've read his autobiography,
oh, yeah.
Markings, which is a deep and profound and spiritual book, actually. And the history of the UN has been, I think, in many ways a history of preventing wars.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, what I'm saying is that it starts out with everybody being very happy about it. It looks like it's going to be a great thing for the first 3.5 years, and then something comes along in the process which is going to change all of that. And there's going to be uprisings, and basically what it tells us in the book of Daniel is an example. Mm-hmm. It said that there will be 10 leaders that shall arise. That goes right along with the Club of Rome, with the 10 regions of the country. And for some reason or another, 3 of these leaders are taken out. Well, that's war. And then that leads you right into the apocalypse that's described in the book of Revelation. And it turns out to be a bad thing for us and for the whole world.
Yeah, we're talking with John Pinkston. And by the way, the website is watchamerica.com. John, you're suggesting that the UN is going to be the instrument of this one world government that's going to be this terrible thing and bring about the Antichrist.
No, sir. I don't believe it will be the UN. I think it's going to be a wholly different organization that's going to come on the site because...
Well, let me give you a candidate.
Okay.
What about the World Trade Organization? Here you have the largest corporations in the world. Right
mm-hmm.
now, more than half of all the world's GDP, you know, more than half... The more than half of, if you were to call the GDPs of countries and corporations as the same.
Uh-huh.
The 100 largest GDPs in the world, more than half of them are actually corporations and not even countries.
Yeah.
And in the World Trade Organization, a corporation can sue a country, and has on many occasions,
yep,
and actually change their laws, overturn their sovereignty. When we signed the treaties that brought us into NAFTA and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, which created the World Trade Organization, I would suggest to you that George Herbert Walker Bush and his New World Order, you know, if you want to get paranoid or worried about something, I don't mean that in a dismissive way,
mm-hmm,
it seems that the WTO is and worldwide corporate governance. I mean, GE just moved the second of their six divisions to London. They do more business outside the United States than inside the United States. We're no longer seeing American corporations that are American corporations.
I totally agree with you, and that's my point. Is that it's? I wrote an article for our magazine called "Business and the Beast," and it's business that's driving all of this. And you know, whether they care about people or not, their real interest is corporate profits. And
by law.
And I think that this is really the driving force. In fact, the matter is, again, referring to what it says in the Bible, it says when this fellow takes over, he says that through his policy, he shall cause craft to prosper at his hand and shall magnify himself. And this is a business-type thing. The problem is that it's not about protecting the rights of people. It's not about bringing peace to nations. It's about bringing business and having business control what happens. And all it takes is for one despot to get in there, and that's exactly what's going to happen. And then he has business at his own control. Look at Hitler.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
well, you know, and yeah, and there are some who suggest that perhaps you know, some of Nostradamus's prophecies and whatnot were about Hitler, mm-hmm, and perhaps even Revelation. But I would say, you know, we've always had despots. You know, Alexander the Great. Various Caligula. I mean, but let me ask you. You know, I started this out. I don't want to say tongue in cheek, but because you and I disagree, I'm not so worried about this on a religious basis. But I would like to ask a serious and political question.
Okay.
Mike Huckabee, I suspect, shares your perspective. George Bush has largely said that he shares your perspective. Ronald Reagan, on several different occasions, spoke with a number of different people in sometimes public, sometimes private venues about how he thought that the end of the world would probably come in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
His Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, when he was asked why he was selling off Western lands at pennies on the dollar, said Jesus is going to return soon and all things will be made new, so it doesn't matter if we essentially rape America by the mining companies. To what extent do you think that Republican politics right now are influenced by millennialist thought like this?
Oh, I don't think much, because George Bush doesn't believe this way. George Bush and his father are very much towards globalism.
But they talk this way.
Yeah, but they may talk this way, but they are very much supportive of that. This is why.
So you think George Bush is part of the Antichrist bunch?
No, I don't think he's part of the Antichrist, but I do believe that W and everybody after him, with the passage of NAFTA and virtually all the political candidates, see this thing as a world government, as a good thing, as opposed to a bad thing.
Now, how about Mike Huckabee?
I don't think he understands this, really.
The guy's an ordained Baptist preacher.
Well, again, from what I've heard, I don't see that he would even have a clue as to what we're talking about today.
Yeah,
and
you think it's beyond John McCain's reach as well, I'm assuming?
Yes, sir, I sure do.
So where in the Republican Party is there somebody speaking about this?
Yeah, nobody's speaking about it, and this is not in my opinion, it's not a Republican or Democrat issue, because neither one of the parties are addressing it at all.
It's a worldwide issue. Well, people can learn more about it at your website, watchamerica.com. John Pinkston. John, thanks for coming on with our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment today. We appreciate it.
I really appreciate your having me. Take care.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Past the hour, Tom Hartman program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, letting our sponsors, particularly our local sponsors, know that you're listening to them and that you support your local radio station. And by our national sponsors like SEIU 1199. the 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care, because health care in the United States should be a right, not a privilege. 21 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Luisa in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Luisa, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I actually, if you keep people arguing about religion, the corporatists can take over. It just dawned on me from the last gentleman that spoke. Christianity, to me, is just another mythology for people to cope with their mortality. And I do think all religions are a sort of brainwashing to control the masses. But initially, I wanted to speak about the differences between the religious right and, I don't know, the rest of us. When you use words, you just kind of box people in with labeling and generalizations. But I've always felt that free thinkers, the progressives are free thinkers. They can be challenged because they have the capacity to put themselves in the shoes of others. They can expand their minds. They're tolerant, open-minded, inclusive. And throughout my life, depression, one of the symptoms of depression has been that you live in this either-or, black or white, yes or no kind of mindset. None of us knows what's going to happen. So how can people claim that theirs is the only way?
Luisa, I think in many regards, and thank you for the call, you have identified the basis of liberalism in, you know, accepting at least the concept of another person having a point of view that is worthy of evaluating. I mean, it's certainly out of the liberal enlightenment. Interesting. Marilyn in Oceanside, Washington, or New York, rather. Hey, Marilyn.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. We listen to you every day.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a comment about Hillary bashing. It seems to me that the media has been doing a lot of Hillary bashing constantly, especially someone like Chris Matthews, comparing her several months ago to Eva Perón. Now, what is it? Something should be said for experience.
Well, wait a second. Eva Perón was very popular.
Yes, I know, but she was also she was a dictator who really did a lot of bad things. A lot of people were killed because of her. And also,
are you sure? I don't know the history of Eva Perón.
Well,
my understanding was that she was swept
in Latin American history, and I did read about that. But I want to get back to this thing about Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a glass ceiling in our country. Many men feel that a woman can't be in charge, can't be the president. You know, I've met people in my area who talk about that. And after all over the rest of the world, many women have been in charge of things, like right now in Germany. The prime minister there is a woman. And years ago, Thatcher in London. And also, there has to be something said for experience. Obama has a lot of charisma, but there isn't a lot of substance. Hillary has a lot of experience, and something should be said for experience. Another thing, he wasn't able to vote on the war because he was not a U.S. senator at the time.
Yeah, Marilyn, you can, you're going through your talking points here.
I wanted to tell you while I was listening to everybody else.
Oh, okay. But to your original point, which I think is really the big one, which is the glass ceiling.
Right.
I think that you raise a really good and important point, and I thank you very much for calling and making that. And that is that African Americans were at least technically freed in the United States 70 years more or less, or 60 years more or less, before women were. And you know, we forget that at our peril. I think that sexism is far more subtle but far more ingrained in our culture among all races than racism is. And I don't have a solution for it, but I acknowledge it, and I think that more of us need to do that. Lynn in Seattle. Hey, Lynn, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Tom, I wanted to ask you a question. I can't think of anybody better to ask. I lived in another country for many years, over 25. I lived in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for all the nice things you've said about Iceland over the last few years.
Oh, it's a country
I went into the caucus place here in the Seattle area. Burien, mm-hmm, actually was my precinct.
Mm-hmm.
And I never showed my identification the entire time. I went home, I had my passport, I had my driver's license with me, and I realized when I got home that no one ever asked me to show any identification. I'm wondering, is that the way it's done here?
Well, traditionally, I don't recall ever having had to show ID when I voted. Perhaps my voter registration card once when we lived in Atlanta, I remember I had to dig that out and show it to somebody. But by and large, they figure if you know right off the top of your head, obviously, who you are and where you live, and, you know, you find yourself on the polls and you've made the trouble to show up. Fact of the matter is, Lynn, that voter fraud, where people show up to vote when they legally can't, is a virtually non-existent crime in the United States. It's something that the Republicans hysterically talk about all the time because their goal is to disenfranchise as many people as possible because they know that with their agenda, they cannot win if the majority of the people in the United States vote, legally eligible citizens. So their mission is to knock as many people off the rolls as possible, particularly in Democratic areas, and to get hysterical about voter fraud. On the other hand, election fraud, like the Republicans did in New Hampshire when they jammed phone banks, like they did in Florida when they threw all kinds of African-Americans off the rolls, big problem.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number 1-866-303-2270, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for the Air America blog as well. Cindy in Montana, thanks for calling, Cindy. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was just wondering what people think about all the war talk that McCain espouses all the time. It really, really scary to me. He talks about being in Iraq either. He said American people don't care if we're there for 1,000 years. And then this is the beginning of many wars. And I don't think we need a man like that in office. Actually, it scares me, and I think everybody should run for cover. This man is not standing for what Americans stand for. And that's all he talks about.
I know the glory of war, and it's unusual because when you see people, and thank you, Cindy, for that, and thank you for listening to us there in Missoula. When you look at people, you know, like Colin Powell or Dwight Eisenhower, who saw people die on the field of battle. And frankly, I don't know if McCain did or not. He was a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot. He was a pilot who was shot down and then was a prisoner of war throughout the Vietnam War. But when you talk to people who have actually seen, you know, the horrors of war up front and personal, they tend more often than not to be opposed to war rather than
that old Beach Boys song, Bomberan.
That's John McCain, right? And this is the song he was promoing. Let's bomb around. Yeah, I don't think we want it either. Randy in Seattle. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I'm a Roman Catholic atheist who want to support that Christian Bible thumper, and I mean that fondly, who just put on.
Okay.
I mean, you know.
Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segments are where we get folks on who are, you know, not quite in the mainstream, but have interesting stories to tell. And that's, you know, I thought he qualified.
Oh, yeah. And I thought what was interesting was that he and you seem to basically agree about the WTO and the dangers of global corporatism. You just had a different metaphor or a way of talking about it.
Yeah.
It's almost as if he was one of these intuitive thinkers who sensed that there was a problem, and he knew the problem was there, but he thought of it in terms of Bible verses.
Yeah, and it could be. And I, you know, back in 74, I think the year was, I actually read Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth, you know, the book that really popularized this stuff. And I was into it. I confess, I was into it for a while there. And, you know, looking back on that time now, I think, you know, I got swept up into a cult. It was very strange. But this whole thing, you know, setting aside the Antichrist is coming stuff, there really is, I mean, we have to keep in mind, Adolf Hitler's pitch to the German people was 1,000 years of peace. Mm-hmm. The Third Reich was the Reich that was going to unite the world to bring about the biblical the revelations, the thousand years of peace from the Bible. And there were a lot of Germans, and I met these people when I lived in Germany back in the 80s, and I met them when I first started going there in the 70s, who believed that stuff. I mean, they were in their 70s and 80s then, and most of them are dead now, but they actually believed that stuff. You know, they were there gung-ho. Yes, a thousand years of peace, it's a wonderful thing. And so, you know, Randy, your point made. Bill in Queens, New York. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hello, Tom. It's nice to get through to you. It's hard for me to stay on point as I wait for my turn to talk and I hear all these interesting quotes before me, and then I want to go this way and that way.
Yeah, we kind of the show kind of wanders all over the map some days.
But it's great. That's what's great about it.
Thank you.
One of the things that I wanted to address was a number of callers, a lot of callers, not only on your show but on all of the call-in shows, particularly women callers, think that there's some resentment about Hillary because she's a woman.
Yeah.
Now, let me give you my perspective on my post 9/11 view of the world, and I'm talking about September 12th. I thought a woman in leadership position would be wonderful at that point in time because women have a different way of looking at things than men.
It depends on the topic, let's say.
Well, we were talking in the most general of terms.
Sure.
What I'm trying to do now is to allay the concerns of some women out there who think that there are men who don't like Hillary because she's a woman. That's what I just want to address. Yeah. I look at Rwanda, and Rwanda, the legislative body there is comprised about 80% women. And I believe it was because it was women who took the reins of the situation in Rwanda that there was a healing that could take place there. It may have been different if it was a male-dominated post-genocide body that had control of things. So a woman looks at another woman's child and sees her child, not my child and your child.
This is one of the reasons, you know, the reasons that you're identifying and you're doing a very good job of, Bill, is one of the reasons why among the Iroquois, the five nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, four of those five nations, or perhaps it was five of the six ultimate nations, only allowed women to vote, to be members of what, you know, arguably was something sort of like a legislator body.
Mm-hmm.
And the men were the sachems. They were the ones who would go to the, you know, make the long-distance trips for the meetings. But they didn't have the right to make decisions. They had to come back to the community, and then within the community, only the women could vote. So it's a good and interesting point you make. But let me tell you, misogyny, which is a fancy word for the hatred of women, arguably the irrational hatred of women, is alive and well. I mean, here, Rush Limbaugh, for example.
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
So feminism was so that unattractive women could enter the mainstream of society. In other words, women are only objects, and their only value has to do with their appearance. And if you have a movement that says, hey, wait a minute, that's not the case, oh, well, let's attack them. And then he runs this ad on his show for the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox.
Ladies, are you fed up with men calling the shots? Are you looking for a new weapon in the war of the sexes? If you need the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox, you can finally grab the power that's keeping Hillary Clinton safe from tough media questions.
And it goes on like that. And this is misogyny is A, nothing new, B, common on the right. And see, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, you're going to see it in full force, just like you're going to see racism in full force if Barack Obama and anti-Islam, anti-Muslimism, whatever that word is, whatever the Muslim variation on anti-Semitism would be, against Barack Obama, even though he's not Muslim, simply because his middle name is Hussein, they're going to try and portray him as one. I mean, we're going to see the right do all this despicable stuff. It's just, you know, it's just going to happen. So what can you say? Paul in Albuquerque. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Yes, I want to talk of the Obama mania as actually a messianic movement.
Uh-huh.
You've spoken to that person yesterday, I think, mentioned that, and you were concerned. Yeah. I'm a cultural anthropologist. I think you perhaps, with your acquaintance of anthropology, know about messianic movements and even messianic cults.
I'm familiar with a few, and sometimes they end up not being all that toxic. I mean, a good example is Ellen White, who took all of her followers up on the top of a mountain in the 1870s, as I recall, or 1880s, waiting for the end of the world. It didn't happen, and so she reinvented herself as the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is a pretty benign organization, I think.
My favorite movements come about when societies are under stress, like in the United States and the Vietnam, the Iraq situation, and the deteriorating economy, and you have a person that arises that sees the promised land, with usually an outsider or someone who's perceived as different, and this fits.
Yeah, but Paul, the real, I mean, consider Reverend Moon. Here's a guy who's going around.
No, I don't want to talk about,
I mean, that's a real messianic movement. He has claimed that he is here to finish Jesus' work. He is the Son of God, and I
refer you to Barack Obama's autobiographical Dreams of My Father. I've been reading that, and in it he very clearly sees himself as different and as a savior for society. He's been running this way for years, and a lot of the things I've talked about. But
you see this as a negative, Paul?
No, it's just a reality of it.
Don't you think that any politician, any person who aspires to a position where they can actually positively change people's lives or save people's lives, perhaps a lot of physicians as well, have a little bit of that in them, and perhaps it's a healthy impulse?
All politicians, to be successful, have to have a little bit of that kind of stuff of being able to bring about, be committed to one thing or the other.
Yeah.
But as far as there's discrimination and bias toward against females, it's very clear there, not only in Limbaugh's, but also in Ed Schultz and Norman Goldman on Progressive Radio.
Okay, Paul, I don't want to get into picking on an individual talk show host. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janice, what's on your mind?
Hi. Tom, thanks for taking my call. I just have to say that the media is doing a great job of fracturing Democrats. The more they give Barack Obama a pass, the less I could ever vote for him. I cannot volunteer for him, for sure. I mean, just the whole NAFTA thing, he wasn't even in the Senate for that, but yet he voted for Peru when he had a chance to stand up against free trade.
But now he's speaking against free trade. And,
but
and
he voted for Peru free trade.
No, I understand. I understand. John Edwards took some votes, too, that he later, repudiated. It's fine with me. If a politician wants to change their mind or wants to take the positions that I think are the right positions.
He also opposed the Kerry Amendment to withdraw troops from Iraq.
Yeah. Janice, thank you for your point. We could go through the talking points about why Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton are good or bad on either side. And, ultimately, I'm going to let you make up your own mind on that. 45 minutes past the hour.
I ain't live forever. But I've lived enough. And I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough. I found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
Welcome, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jim in Berkeley, California, says you want to disagree with me. What's up?
Yeah, hi. Two things. One is on Hillary, and I may not get to it also, although I'm really kind of sick of the victim, the victim line that I hear from too many Hillary supporters and that every criticism of her is bashing. Anyway, to the O'Hanlon thing, I listened to that interview. I got to tell you, Tom, to hear your position on it, it sounded during that interview. I don't think you really believe this. But it sure sounded like you would have been fine if the U.S. had just gone in, toppled Saddam, mounted a Marshall Plan, and got out. And we know that the war was based on lies. Other callers.
No, you're absolutely right, Jim. And I should have more clearly differentiated right from the get-go that I thought that the invasion was illegal. It was a criminal act. That Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, all of them are war criminals. I think they should be taken up on charges at The Hague. I think this is on par with Hitler's invasion of Poland. It's equally phony. This is the first time such a horrific act has ever been committed by the United States. That said,
been an interesting conversation with Mike.
Yeah, I think it would have, Jim. You're right, and perhaps I should have started it there. That said, what I wanted to get into with him is why is it that even think tanks and even Democrats are still using the metaphor of war when what we have is an occupation? And frankly, I think the only way we're going to end this thing is to start calling it an occupation, because then Joe Sixpack is going to say, oh, an occupation, yeah, of course, those should end. Whereas Joe Sixpack is going to say, a war? No, we don't want to lose a war. And, you know, in Vietnam, we never got to the point where we had actually knocked down a government. We could say we were occupying. But here in Iraq, we did. We did have a war, an illegal war, and we did win it. And now we've had five and a half years of occupation. So your point is well taken, Jim. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And hey, Ellen, what's happening in Washington, D.C.? I see the FISA vote is going on in the House.
There's a ton going on, and what it looks like is the Blue Dog Dems have hooked up with Mr. Boehner, and they're going to do exactly the same thing that happened in the Senate on that FISA bill.
You're kidding.
No. And that is not good.
Oh, man.
And I don't think Nancy Pelosi is strong enough to keep them from not going.
Well, yeah, the problem is that I suspect it's not just those guys who call themselves Blue Dogs, but there is this coalition of, what is it, 35, 38, something like that, just a little short of 40 Democrats who represent mostly Republican districts who tend to go with the Republicans on things like this. And you know, they're the ones who are able to break the majority. What's she to do?
And there's absolutely nothing that can happen except to wait it out for 6 years, which is when this would come up again.
Oh, well, it can be amended or rewritten in next year, can it?
Well, it certainly can be amended or rewritten, but is any new president going to take that on, especially somebody that's, you know...
I don't think John McCain would, but I think that there's a good chance that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama would do the right thing.
In my fondest fantasies, I hope that would be true.
Yeah. Although history doesn't demonstrate that presidents give up power willingly.
That's for sure. And I don't think, well, I don't know. I just don't know where Hillary Clinton would be. I mean, she has vacillated on some of these terror issues, et cetera. On Obama and Hillary, speaking of Hillary, he came out today with a financial issue talking about an infrastructure bank. Hillary Clinton came right back at him and said that this had been proposed by Hillary Clinton along with Dodd and Senator Hagel. And it's called the National Infrastructure Bank Act, and she's saying that Barack Obama is not giving her credit.
Hmm.
So,
well,
it's
like, what, there's a new idea under the sun?
Right, exactly. A new idea under the sun.
I mean, I thought Franklin Roosevelt actually came up with that one. And then Dwight Eisenhower did a pretty good job with it. You know, let's build the national infrastructure. And by the way, it'll also stimulate the economy. The Eisenhower Highway System, Franklin Roosevelt, dams and rural electrification and buildings and everything else.
Well,
but this is Hillary Clinton's new idea.
But she had put forth an act, and he's saying that Barack Obama is taking credit. And a lot of people think that this is sort of the first step of them going pretty negative on Barack.
Well, have you seen her attack ad in Wisconsin, where she's attacking him for not yet saying that he will debate her in Wisconsin?
They're very upset. They wanted to challenge him to 4 debates, and he is not willing to do that. As you know, so far there's only one on the books, and that's happening in Texas.
Yeah, well, front runners never want a debate because they don't have anything to win. They've got a lot to lose. So.
Exactly. A couple other interesting things. There is a House Homeland Security hearing today. Benny Thompson went after the Homeland Security chief and said that, first of all, Benny Thompson's priorities are border security and port security. The president's budget cuts down on mass transportation and also takes away a lot of that local government security money, which was going to make a big difference to places like New York City.
Hmm.
on the Secretary Rice today was at the Senate Foreign Relations, and Senator Biden took after her, saying that the funding for wars, why was it considered not part of the budget, that he said that they are treading water with the military, and Secretary Rice just kept pushing the political progress and the fact that three bills had recently passed through the Iraqi legislature.
You mean she never answered his question?
Never answered the direct question.
No. Yeah. Gee, what a surprise. Condi Rice prevaricating. But
exactly.
Yeah. Thanks for the heads up, Ellen. Always
message.
Say what?
She stays on message.
She absolutely does. Thanks so much. Ellen Radner at TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen. Tomorrow, it's Valentine's Day, the perfect day to challenge Carrie Lucas, the Independent Women's Forum, about their Take Back the Date campaign to rescue romance from the radical feminists. Uh-oh. And Rabbi Shmuley Botok is going to join me about his new book, The Broken American Male and How to Fix Him. Don't forget, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.